Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the November 13th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Things are changing in the Middle East, and the latest changes appear to have brought new headaches for President Obama and his globetrotting Secretary of State, John Kerry. One perhaps only a temporary casualty is Obama's plan to establish a new relationship with Iran in the post-Ahmadinejad era, and the other has been the emergence of what appears to be a serious crisis in U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia. Already unhappy with the results of the Iraq War, which paved the way for a Shia-led regime with ties to Iran replacing what had long been Sunni ruled territory, the Saudis' ties with the U.S. further unraveled when Washington failed to back up Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak when the crowds in Tahrir Square were demanding his resignation in 2011. They reached their lowest point yet when Obama, faced by the prospect of a certain defeat of his limited war resolution in Congress, backed down on his commitment to bomb Syria and instead offered U.S. backing for a Russian-sponsored deal to get rid of Syria's chemical weapons. This, in Saudi eyes, was tantamount to allowing besieged Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to remain in power. Maintaining good relations with the Saudis goes way beyond access to its oil in the matter of its importance in Washington. It has been the billions of dollars that the Saudis have spent on U.S. weaponry over the years that has kept the U.S. arms industry in business, and now the Desert Sheikdom is threatening to take its business elsewhere. All this is what will be on the agenda 20 minutes past the hour when I once again speak with Middle East analyst Gareth Porter of the Interpress News Service, so stay tuned for that. On the verge of reaching a short-term agreement with Iran over curtailing its nuclear activities this past Sunday, the P5+1 countries were apparently blindsided by the actions of one of its members, French Foreign Secretary Laurent Fabius, who is a late arrival at the crucial meeting. Fabius announced that his country could not go along with the interim accord that all the other participants had agreed upon, thus bringing an abrupt and disappointing conclusion to the initial round of negotiations between the five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany on one side and Iran on the other. According to a report in the Times of Israel, Fabius' decision was based on a warning from a member of the French Parliament that if the U.S. and its allies came to any agreement with Iran that did not result in that country shutting down its nuclear program altogether, Israel would attack Tehran's nuclear facilities on its own. It turns out that the man who passed on that warning, Meir Habib, holds dual French-Israeli citizenship and happens to be the vice president of the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions in France, or CRIF, the French equivalent to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, better known as AIPAC. Habib is also a friend and political ally of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and represents his Likud party in France. Netanyahu, after all, had been issuing nonstop warnings in Israel and the U.S. television, where he apparently has an open invitation, declaring that Israel will not recognize any agreement made between the P5+1 countries and Iran, a position that has opened a visible gap between the U.S. and Israel where, we are told, none exists. Moreover, prior to the conclusion of the first round of negotiations, Netanyahu had been on the phone to all the leaders of the P5 countries and Germany, urging them not to make any deal with Iran that would lessen the already existing draconian sanctions on that country. Upon learning Sunday that France had thrown a monkey wrench into the negotiations, Senator John McCain tweeted, "France had the courage to prevent a bad nuclear agreement with Iran. Vive la France!" Not so fast, John. What lies behind France's decision to sabotage the negotiations may have been more prosaic. In yesterday's Consortium News, Robert Perry, a former Takes on the World guest, writes, quote, "France's sabotage of a compromise agreement on Iran's nuclear program is a textbook case of how the new Saudi-Israel alliance can disrupt President Barack Obama's strategy for resolving Middle East disputes through diplomacy, not war." Over the summer, notes Perry, Saudi officials, including intelligence chief Prince Bandar bin Sultan, visited European capitals, dangling financial deals and energy concessions to countries if they would line up behind Saudi and Israeli desires for military intervention in the Syrian civil war and heightened economic warfare against Iran. The carrots were particularly appealing to the French, who are struggling with a sluggish economy, high unemployment, and a recent credit downgrade. So writes Perry, the flash of Saudi petrodollars got the attention of the French government. Just last month, French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian celebrated the signing of a $1.5 billion deal with Saudi Arabia to overhaul six of its Navy ships. In July, Saudi Arabia's ally, United Arab Emirates, signed a $913 million deal with France to buy two high-resolution Helios military satellites. Other lucrative arms deals are reportedly in the works between France and Saudi Arabia and its Sunni allies, advises Perry. In addition, he says, quote, Saudi Arabia has also deployed its money to bolster France's sagging agricultural and food sectors, including a Saudi firm that brought a major stake in Groupe Dieu, Europe's largest poultry farm based in Britain, end quote. Then there's a totally different take on what happened from our Secretary of State. Countering claims that France had torpedoed the nuclear talks, Kerry, speaking afterward in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, said the six world powers had agreed on a deal, but Iran wasn't ready to accept it. Speaking to reporters, Kerry said the major powers were, quote, unified on Saturday when we presented a proposal to the Iranians and the French signed off on it. We signed off on it and everybody agreed it was a fair proposal. There was unity, said Kerry, but Iran couldn't take it at that particular moment. They weren't able to accept that particular thing, end quote. Kerry added the U.S. was, quote, not in a race to complete talks with Iran on its uranium enrichment program, reaffirming Washington's commitment to defend its allies and not undermine ties with them. When we speak with Gareth Porter 20 minutes past the hour, I hope we get a better take on who is doing what in Geneva. The Israeli-Saudi alliance is not as improbable as it first appears. Both countries oppose any deal with Iran that doesn't dismantle its nuclear program, and both view the Shia alliance of Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah as their main external enemy. At the UN Security Council, instead of providing weapons to the armed opposition to al-Assad, as the Saudis had hoped for, and instead had agreed to the destruction of Syria's stock of chemical weapons, was apparently one of the main reasons that the Saudis recently surprised the world and turned down the rotating seat on the Security Council that it had long lobbied for. It's the Iran issue that has created the potential for a break between Tel Aviv and Washington that exceeds in intensity any of the problems between the two governments during Obama's first term. 2 weeks ago, in an important meeting at the White House that went totally unreported by the mainstream media, high-level administration officials, including National Security Advisor Susan Rice, met with four representatives of four right-leaning Jewish groups to ask them not to lobby Congress for new sanctions at that point. The four reportedly gave the administration, quote, a limited grace period after, quote, an understanding was reached with the top staff of the National Security Council that they wouldn't ask for more sanctions yet if they are assured that Washington wouldn't weaken sanctions against Iran during the P5+1 meeting that just concluded. President what described as a tense meeting were executives from AIPAC, the American Jewish Committee, which is the foreign policy arm of the Israel lobby, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Conference of Presidents of major Jewish American organizations. Though they refrained from describing it as a deal or a quid pro quo, sources familiar with the meeting said they had agreed to a limited grace period only after hearing assurances from the administration that it had no intention of easing sanctions or releasing Iranian funds that had been frozen in banks around the world. But as the New York Jewish Weekly Forward reports, the push against Iran is not just coming from the largest Jewish organizations. For members of Congress, it reports, the pressure is not just to maintain, but to increase the current far-reaching economic and trade sanctions against Iran. And it's coming not just from the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee in Washington, but also from the local level, district by district, where Jewish groups are engaged in a push that is almost unprecedented in its intensity and breadth. The aim is to pass legislation that will further sanction Iran, even as talks are in process. The Jewish groups, notes the Forward, are also pushing to limit the Obama administration's room to negotiate an agreement that does not include a complete and unconditional suspension of uranium enrichment by Iran, end quote. That happens to be the position of the Netanyahu government, but not Washington's nor of any of the P5+1 countries. Then there's a suggestion of Sheldon Adelson, you know him, the Las Vegas and Macau casino owner, one of the world's richest men, who 2 years ago told an Israeli audience that he regrets having served in the U.S. Army and not the Israeli Army. And, of course, he gave $100 million to the Republican Party candidates in the last election. Adelson's plan of dealing with Iran, which I'm sure you haven't read or heard, as he told an audience at Yeshiva University, would be to drop a nuclear bomb in the Iranian desert, which would send a message to Tehran as to what would happen to the country if it continues working on producing a nuclear weapon, which, of course, is not proved. According to the Jerusalem Post and a number of other Jewish publications in Israel and the United States, Adelson imagined what might happen if an American official were to call an Iranian official up on the phone and say, "Watch this," and subsequently drop a nuclear bomb in the middle of the Iranian desert. Then you say, "See, the next one's in the middle of Tehran, so we mean business. You want to get wiped out? Go ahead and take a tough position and continue with your nuclear development. You want to be peaceful? Just reverse it all. We'll guarantee you that you can have a nuclear power plant for electricity purposes, for energy purposes," end quote. As I say, no major American media carried that story. Meanwhile, Shemi Shalav, Haaretz's Washington correspondent, writes that, quote, "If there were a synoptic nap for diplomatic storms, the National Weather Service would be putting out a hurricane warning right now. The winds are blowing cold, tensions are on the rise, and tempers are beginning to flare in the Bermuda Triangle of relations between Israel, the U.S., and the American Jewish community. And given that the turbulence is being caused by an issue long deemed to be critical to Israel's very existence, we may actually be facing a rare Category 5 flare-up, a superstorm of U.S.-Israel relations." Shalev explains that Netanyahu's expressions of frustration and anger stem from the substance of the emerging agreement being negotiated, as well as the fact that it appears to have taken Israel by surprise. After receiving assurances from the administration that it would not seek an interim deal and that it would not offer partial sanction relief, Washington, in Jerusalem's eyes at least, appears to be doing just that. The prime minister's videotaped no-holds-barred condemnation on Friday of the very bad deal that Israel utterly rejects, says the foreword, photographed an unflattering close-up that only magnified its ominous resonance, seems to get the stage for a monumental confrontation. At the very least, writes Shalev, a first-step agreement on Iran's nuclear program could trigger a congressional counteroffensive aimed at strengthening sanctions rather than relieving them, with Israel and its supporters in Washington rallying to help undermine the Geneva Accord. The stakes and the potential fallout, writes Shalev, couldn't be higher, end quote. Shalev is referring to what is widely conceded but left unstated, that Congress is Israeli-occupied territory and it answers to Netanyahu and not to the President of the United States. He writes about the intensified feelings within Israeli government circles as a result of what he notes, quote, seems to be an American effort to undercut its own pledge to keep the military option on the table in its dealings with Iran. He cites a senior U.S. official who told reporters in Geneva that a military attack on Iran, quote, would not end, in our view, Iran's nuclear program. It would set it back, but it would not end it, end quote. Shalev points out that, quote, the administration is likely to face a steep uphill battle to prevent Congress from taking direct action to undermine a Geneva agreement. Obama's approval ratings have never been lower, he writes. He is struggling to keep his Affordable Care Act afloat, and Democratic lawmakers up for re-election in 2014 were starting to keep their distance even before an Iranian agreement was in the offing, end quote. That's Haaretz's Hemi Shalev. The negotiations with Iran are scheduled to resume 1 week from today. Given the apparent failure of the first round of talks, it is questionable whether either Obama or Kerry will be able to prevent the Senate from passing a new set of sanctions. 2 weeks ago, Reuters reported that Robert Menendez, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, told an AIPAC meeting in New York that a package of sanctions ready to move in his chamber has a goal of cutting Iran's oil exports to 500,000 barrels per day. That's twice as much as a more severe bill passed by the House in July would have allowed, which aimed to reduce Iran's oil exports to near zero. Since the beginning of 2012, U.S. and European sanctions have cut Iran's oil exports to about 1 million barrels a day from 2.5 million, costing Tehran billions of dollars a month in helping to spike inflation and unemployment. Menendez, a New Jersey Democrat, said Iran must freeze and dismantle its nuclear program and demonstrate it has done so before sanctions are lifted. Menendez said the sanctions package would require China, India, South Korea, Turkey, and Japan, Iran's remaining oil customers, to further slash their purchases of Iranian crude and other petroleum products. In other words, it would not just be the Congress pitted against Iran, but against some key U.S. allies. Secretary of State Kerry will be meeting with senators today to try and talk them out of those new sanctions. Finally, if you happen to be in the vicinity of Napa's Silverado Resort the weekend of October 11th and had trouble driving or finding parking, you'll be relieved to know you're being discomfited by AIPAC, which was holding its annual summit for members who had contributed a minimum of $3,600 to the lobbying organization in the previous year. It was the weekend when the federal government in Washington was shut down and lawmakers were trying to find a way to get the government back to functioning. Our own Senator Barbara Boxer and a Republican chum, Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, had different priorities, however. The two senators were featured speakers at the three-day AIPAC affair, from which the press was, of course, excluded. It must be comforting for Israeli and American Israel-American supporters that even when our two political parties appear to beat each other's throats, they act as lovebirds when it comes to demonstrating their affection for Israel.